Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Lawmakers have sent several new bills on to the governor for approval, including one that follows a recommendation from his task force to re-examine the 1020 Life Law.
It originated from the governor, Governor Scott's 2013 Citizens Safety and Protection Task Force, which was made up of state attorney, prosecutors, police chiefs, and citizens.
Also tonight, state lawmakers are working on a system for death sentences, but some say the new provisions need a bit more work.
It would still be at the lowest common denominator of any of the remaining death penalty states.
We'll also explore the idea of computer coding, substituting for public school foreign language course requirements, and some dabbling in foreign policy by the Florida legislature. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the end of week six of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capital Report. While the Florida legislative session is more than half over, Governor Rick Scott's work is just beginning. Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers sent another bundle of bills to the governor's desk this week.
Governor Rick Scott has already signed off on a few of the priority measures pushed by leaders in the House and Senate, with a bill signing early in the session. But since then, more measures have been slowly piling up. The governor has several more bills to sign, including one that would prohibit residential gun ranges. Auburndale Republican Representative Neil Comby sponsored the bill in the House.
Would affirmatively declare that discharging a firearm in a residential area with a density of one residence to the acre or greater is a misdemeanor.
Venice Republican Representative Julio Gonzalez says he's glad to see the bill moving forward. He's hopeful it will help to clear up an issue that has arisen in his district.
This is a very important issue in my district, particularly affecting the great city of Northport, whose county city commissioner we saw here last night. The police was in a quandary of how to even approach this issue for individuals who were using their backyards as a firing range.
Another measure waiting for the governor's attention relates to minimum mandatory sentences. The bill gets rid of minimum mandatory sentences for aggravated assault by removing the crime from the 1020 life statute. Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean is the bill's Senate sponsor. Meanwhile, Comby is sponsoring the bill in the House. He says he's been working on the measure for years.
It originated from the governor, Governor Scott's 2013 Citizens Safety and Protection Task Force, which was made up of state attorney, prosecutors, police chiefs, and citizens.
Comby says the task force recommended a review of the 1020 Life Law to get rid of any unintended consequences.
In recent years, people have been convicted of crimes such as aggravated assault for threatening to use force and have been sentenced to mandatory minimum sentences pursuant to the 1020 Life. These cases, I believe, and others fell out of the legislative intent behind this law.
The governor has until February 25th to take action on both those bills along with several others. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Florida House has approved a new capital sentencing scheme, raising the bar for convictions, but the House plan doesn't require a unanimous jury decision for recommending the death penalty. Nick Evans spoke with Mark Schlackman of the Center for the Advancement of Human Rights at Florida State University.
Back in January, the Supreme Court struck down the way that Florida does death penalty sentencing. The way that the death penalty is sentenced has to do with aggravators and mitigators. So can you just briefly describe for me just a thumbnail sketch of, you know, what that looks like?
Before the case that you mentioned, Hearst, Florida was an outlier. It was the only state of the remaining 31 death penalty states in the United States to allow simple majorities, 7-5, to decide the presence of a sufficient number of aggravating circumstances. But here's the curiosity of that. You could have had seven jurors selecting different aggravators. So in other words, the practical effect was a penalty phase jury of 12 might not have any agreement whatsoever on any aggravators. This is before Hurst. And that could suffice as a legally sufficient basis to move on to the second prong. And the second prong is the jury would determine whether then to recommend death. And that, too, was simple majority. Hurst basically revisited Florida's death penalty statute and said Florida's capital case sentencing scheme did not comport with Sixth Amendment requirements, in that the jury provided an advisory recommendation and the judge was the ultimate sentencing authority.
Now, under the new schemes that have been developed in the Senate and the House, that last phase, the one where the judge would have been the final sentencing authority, what does it look like now under these proposals?
It's still pending legislative reconciliation. And I think it's important to note that in the first instance, unanimity will be the standard. You asked about that second prong, the jury recommendation. The Senate bill is a unanimous requirement. The House initially was a 9-3. Well, subsequently, it appears as though the House has moved to 10-2. And then it will be a question of whether the Senate holds or is willing to consider that.
So, for example, in a jury trial dealing with a fact situation, the question of guilt or question of innocence, if there is not unanimity, in other words, if there is a hung jury, you have a do-over. But in the sentencing phase, if you had unanimity, there is no do-over.
Okay, so that's Jacksonville Republican Representative Charles McBurney. He's laying out the case that if the standard for sentencing were unanimity, you raise the potential for, say, a rogue juror to hold up the process. And this focuses on, of course, the victims' families. If you require unanimity, then they won't get closure. Do you have any response to that?
I've certainly heard that. I'm not sure I understand the position that requiring unanimity in terms of that second prong for jury recommendations wouldn't allow for closure. It would. There's some really compelling research in this area by Scott Sundby, among others.
I heard him in one of the hearings. Go on.
Yeah, University of Miami School of Law speaks directly to these issues. For instance, what he said about a unanimity requirement is that it changes the very nature of the jury deliberations. The jurors are more invested in the process, feel more responsible for the outcome. And so it improves the quality of the process. And here's a really interesting point. He said in instances where, say, a preliminary survey or vote is in the range of 9-3, that if the requirement is unanimity, in many instances, that preliminary 9-3 vote will, by way of the deliberations that ensue, move to a unanimous vote.
One of the things that struck me is, you know, where does the number 9 come from? And then when they make the change to 10, where does the number 10 come from? Does Florida face any jeopardy because of the arbitrary nature of its requirements?
Yeah, Nick, that's what I was alluding to. The Florida, if it went to 10-2, would be with Alabama, Delaware pending review of its process. But for that, every other state in the nation that maintains a death penalty today requires unanimity. Florida would still be at the edge of constitutional scrutiny. So I guess to oversimplify, is the current House position of 10-2 arguably better, quote, better than a simple majority requirement? Yeah, I think simple or lawyer's math might say yes, but it still doesn't reach the bar that unanimity would provide.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for coming in to talk with me about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nick.
That was Nick Evans speaking with Mark Schlackman from the Florida State University Center for the Advancement of Human Rights. Legislation that would bar cities from using red light cameras to issue traffic tickets is now ready for a vote by the full Florida House of Representatives. A bill to repeal the 2010 law that authorized the use of the cameras passed its final House committee this week. Proponents of the repeal bill say the cameras do very little to improve traffic safety, and they're simply a new way to generate revenue for local governments. However, even as the bill moves in the House, the measure is currently stalled in a Senate subcommittee. Proponents of red light cameras say they do change the behavior of drivers at intersections where the cameras are located. They also say local governments should be able to decide for themselves whether or not they want the cameras. Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida legislature decides getting involved in U.S. foreign policy might be a good thing, especially for those who don't like the policy espoused by the Obama administration.
You literally memorialize in a memorial that the United States has recognized the Cuban government. How do you not view that as an implicit recognition by the Florida House that the Cuban government is a legitimate government?
Could computer coding substitute as a foreign language requirement for public school students? At least one Florida lawmaker thinks it's a good idea.
So I've always believed, and stronger than ever now, that computer coding and technology is really more of a liberal arts than it is a STEM.
And American Sign Language interpreters play a vital role in the education of deaf or hard of hearing students. As more deaf students move into neighborhood public schools, qualified interpreters are now more important than ever.
Maybe only the interpreter at school is the only person in the whole school who can communicate with that child really well. They have limited access to people, and that could be very detrimental to the child.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
Miami is the gateway to the Caribbean and South America, and the old joke is nobody can get elected Miami mayor without a foreign policy. Well, when it hasn't been debating abortion, gay rights, and charter schools, the Florida legislature has been developing a foreign policy of its own, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Representative Frank Artiles of Miami is Cuban-American, but he's also a conservative Republican. So he doesn't think the federal government should immediately grant public assistance to Cuban refugees while it forces others to wait 5 years. After all, Artiles argues, the Cold War is over. At least that's what he thought before his memorial to Congress landed in front of the House State Affairs Committee and Republican committee member Matt Gaetz.
You literally memorialize in a memorial that the United States has recognized the Cuban government. How do you not view that as an implicit recognition by the Florida House that the Cuban government is a legitimate government?
Artiles said he disagrees with President Barack Obama's recognition of Cuba. He stressed he's no fan of the Castro regime. But Gaetz wasn't satisfied. He reminded Artiles a North Korean freighter loaded with Cuban military hardware was seized in the Panama Canal 2 years ago.
Those weapon systems were parts of intercontinental ballistic missiles being sent from Cuba to another sociopath dictator who points out American cities on the map that he'd like to wipe out.
The Soviet Union may be history, but the Cold War marches on, Gaetz said.
As you evaluate the increase in Russian aggression, the desire by Vladimir Putin to reconstitute the Soviet Empire, the degradation of national sovereignty in Eastern Europe, the fact that the Baltic states are at risk, that NATO allies are at risk, do you have a concern that we are re-entering a period with Russia where our relationship has chilled to the point of cold?
And Artiles' bill was a non-binding memorial. Other lawmakers are upset with U.S. foreign policy, too, and they want to take more concrete steps. Republican Representative Lake Ray of Jacksonville is convinced Obama's pledge to help resettle refugees from war-torn Syria is a dangerous mistake. Ray's solution is a bill entitled Prevention of Acts of War.
It authorizes the governor to take all lawful steps to prevent the settling of dangerous immigrants and refugees. It directs the governor and attorney general to resist federal efforts to resettle dangerous persons in the state of Florida.
Ray's bill has 11 co-sponsors, but its prospects are dim. A legislative analysis points out the bill is likely unconstitutional under the federal preemption clause. Ray said he just wanted to start a conversation, and he outdid himself. Francesca Menez, policy coordinator with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, said Ray's bill is one reason her group flooded the Capitol courtyard recently with more than 100 protesters. Menez says legislative interest in foreign policy and international affairs tends to track the election cycle. She says the tone of the legislation usually reflects the views of the presidential frontrunner.
Unfortunately, it depends on what election cycle, because in 2014, we had positive immigrant legislation that were presented. But this year, we have anti, and that's partly because of the rhetoric, the anti-hate rhetoric and anti-immigrant rhetoric that's been pushed out by Donald Trump.
The biggest foreign policy lever lawmakers have is the $176 billion state pension fund. In 2007, the legislature told pension managers to stop investing in firms doing business with state sponsors of terror, like Iran, Cuba, and Syria. But the Protecting Florida's Investments Act expired when Obama lifted sanctions against Iran, and Republicans are working this session to renew it. And Republican Senator Joe Negron is sponsoring a bill that would ban investing in companies taking part in a worldwide boycott of Israel.
My view is companies and businesses and countries, they can make their decisions on who they want to do business with. That's their choice. But then we also have a choice as Floridians and as policymakers on how we want to respond to that.
Negron's bill and the House companion are both awaiting floor votes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Computer coders have found a champion in Florida Senator Jeremy Ring. Ring, a former Yahoo executive, believes coding is an art rather than a science. Lynn Hatter reports he's putting forth an idea to allow Florida students to choose coding in order to fulfill a foreign language requirement for college. And both chambers of the state legislature could approve the bill next week.
Florida students don't have to take a foreign language to graduate from a public high school, but the state's public university system does require at least 2 years of study in another language in order to be accepted. And Margate Democratic Senator Jeremy Ring says why not broaden the language offerings? Instead of the usual suspects like French or Spanish, why not something like Python or C++?
Whether you're going to politics, it doesn't really matter, sales. You need to have a technology understanding in order to compete in life and in order to compete in a professional environment. So I've always believed, and stronger than ever now, that computer coding and technology is really more of a liberal arts than it is a STEM.
Code runs the world. It's what computers run on and how TVs operate. And at Leon County's Sale High School, it's hopefully the ticket to a big win in an upcoming robotics competition.
I'm Jason Burdick, teacher at Sale High School. I run the robotics program as an after-school activity and also teach a robotics class and lead mentor for the Octopirate Robotic Club.
And you are?
I am Ron Moore. I am the lead programmer for the Octopirate Robotics Club.
The group's 3D printer is whirring away as it turns PVC pipe into a red Lego-like piece that will be added onto the robot the students are building.
These are our front manipulators. So this is where our ball intake comes. We grab the ball, we sandwich it between these two jaws.
This vehicle, with its 8 lime green rubber wheels, square-framed steel structure, and vertical scooping arm, has been designed to roll, climb, and grab. The Octopirates are in the final days before their project gets packed up and sealed and sent off to compete. There's not a class dedicated solely to coding, and many of the Octopirates, like Rom, are self-taught.
I mean, I mostly learned on my own, and I took AP Computer Science, and then from there, I've taught myself a lot of higher skills.
Jeremy Rings, Senate Bill 468, requires the Department of Education to have a coding course in place by the 2018-19 school year. The proposal is also getting kudos from Silicon Valley and, more specifically, Microsoft Chairman John Thompson. Thompson says coding is a skill that's becoming increasingly necessary for students, and he asks, what's wrong with letting kids try it out?
And so if you had a chance to take coding, and coding triggered a thought in your mind that, gee, I can do this and do it well, and it has the long-term consequences of a career in technology, mm-hmm. which right now are some of the highest-paying careers in our country, why wouldn't you do that? I think that's a great idea.
But it's not all props for coding in Florida. Many people acknowledge the need for it. But what they don't like is the idea coding could replace what many consider another necessary skill, knowing another language. Linda Markley with the Florida Foreign Language Association says the benefits of bilingualism shouldn't be ignored. And she argues coding is not the same as a world language.
The Florida Bureau of Labor Market Statistics for 2023 projections for new job openings say that over 300,000 will require world language skills as opposed to 48,000 for computer coding.
But Sale High School Octopirate Alexander Olson says coding is not only relevant, it's vital.
Because it really is a whole nother language, and I would have much rather learned something like this back when I was in middle school than learning Spanish for 2 years that I already forgot half of, and that was only 2 or 3 years ago. And I think this would have stuck with me a lot longer, and it would have been something I was a lot more interested in.
And Senator Ring insists it's not an either-or proposition. He says coding is not about creating new engineers. It's an essential skill people need to have to navigate changing technologies. And he argues if Florida were truly serious about its foreign languages, it would need to start kids out at a younger age in immersion programs. But until then, Ring believes there's room for both. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Legislative leaders say compromise will be needed to bridge vast differences in their respective tax cut and economic incentives proposals. All that as Governor Rick Scott continues to stand firm that his request will bolster Florida's economy. In a release today announcing that Labino Power Systems, an aeronautical power and electric systems firm, will expand its footprint in Manatee County, the governor touted his request for $1 billion in tax cuts and $250 million for business recruitment incentives. But across the Capitol, the need to compromise appears to be in the air. There are still 3 weeks left in the regular session, and Senate President Andy Gardner told reporters that the incentives and tax cuts need to be decided before budget allocations can be set. Such allocations are a key first step in budget negotiations because they determine how much money will go to each major spending area, such as education and health care. The House has rolled out a nearly $1 billion tax cut package, which features many cuts Scott has sought, while the Senate is looking at about $250 million in cuts. Meanwhile, the Senate has matched the governor's $250 million incentives ask, which would be handled through the private public enterprise Florida. The House, meanwhile, has proposed $80 million, even as some members believe increasing the total from the current year's $43 million in incentives funding is too high. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the concept of language isn't restricted to computer coding and the spoken word. Currently, there are no standard qualifications for American Sign Language interpreters in public schools. But Thursday, the Florida House passed a bill unanimously that could change that, as we hear from Kate Payne.
Yeah, you know, our hairdressers, you know, are required to have licenses. Right? But not our interpreters? I mean, you have interpreters working with deaf children. Can you imagine? Does that make a whole lot of sense to you?
That's June McMahon with the Florida Association of the Deaf, speaking through an interpreter. After hearing concerns like McMahon's, Representative Lori Berman of Boynton Beach is working on a bill that could make a difference.
Florida is one of only five states that has no standard for sign language interpreter qualifications in K-12 programs.
American Sign Language, or ASL, is a living language with its own grammar, syntax, dialects, and slang. Terry Schisler is an interpreter, and she says sign language is just as complex as spoken language.
So it doesn't limit a person to be able to use sign language. It's equivalent to use any other spoken language, which is hard for a lot of people to realize that it's not a simple form of communication. It doesn't, it's not basic language where we can communicate basic needs. It's a robust language all of its own.
When it comes to interpreting ASL, there's more to it than simply knowing the signs. Schisler says a good interpreter conveys not just words, but the spirit behind those words.
In French or Spanish or any other spoken languages, I may be saying the words, but I don't really understand the meaning of what I'm saying. So you can't just interpret the words. You have to understand the cultural implications of what's being said.
The need for qualified interpreters is not a new one, but it is a symptom of broader changes in deaf education. Over the past 40 years, more deaf and hard of hearing students are moving away from specialized schools and into their neighborhood public schools. Here's June McMahon again.
They're in classrooms primarily with hearing students with an interpreter. So if the interpreter isn't certified, often the deaf children are really left struggling because they don't have good language access, and that's critical.
Gallaudet University researchers call these students pebbles in the mainstream, scattered across primarily hearing communities. That's why qualified interpreters are so important. Interpreters are a link between the deaf world and the hearing world. If that connection breaks, the whole system shuts down. Here's Schisler again.
Maybe only the interpreter at school is the only person in the whole school who can communicate with that child really well. So they have limited access to people, and that could be very detrimental to the child.
Many deaf students have to choose between the cultural experience of deaf education or the comforts of home in a hearing community that truly may not understand them. State lawmakers want to ensure that either way, those students are getting the robust education they deserve. The House passed Berman's bill unanimously Thursday. The Senate version still has two more committee stops before it's ready for a floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.